planned degrowth. So we're not talking about a recession. We're talking about careful planning.
You are listening to the Post Growth Australia podcast, the one podcast where size don't matter and where better is better than bigger. Welcome back, folks, to another episode of Post Growth Australia podcast. I'm your co-host, Michael Bayliss.
And I am your other co-host, Mark Allen.
Guess what, Mark? Our last episode did very, very well.
That is fantastic to hear.
We interviewed Kate Booth, and it was the first episode, I believe, on PGAP that talked about collapse directly. And I was a little bit nervous about how people would respond to it, but we ended up getting more listener feedback than we ever had in our history.
Well, I think all of us have a deep-seated understanding that collapse is a very real reality, and it was a good opportunity to bring that to the forefront.
And would you like me to share two of our feedbacks?
As long as they're nice. I don't want to hear the bad ones. Not now, anyway. Not till I've, since I've had a few beers.
I hear you've moved from coffee to beers now.
Well, when I get bad reviews, I drink beer. When I get good reviews, I drink coffee.
All right. Well, you get to have two coffees after this.
Ah, fantastic.
One of the first feedbacks I'd like to share with our lovely listeners is Brett from Western Australia, our new home turf. And Brett says, there should be a law against it, growth. This is my response to many causes of the existential crisis we are in, as policies without teeth have little impact. Thanks so much for your important podcast, which I only recently discovered. So Brett is working toward a Wellbeing of Future Generations Act in Western Australia, partly inspired by the guests on our past episode to whom he's gotten into contact with. And to me, this is what PGAP is all about, or what I want it to be about, a way to get people together, listen to new ideas, and get into contact with the guests and be in touch to work on common causes.
That's a great way forward. That has to be the future. We need to work together, look for our common ground, build a movement that's bigger than the sum of its parts. So any opportunity to do that, whether it's through a podcast or any other forum or method of communicating, is something we need to encourage as we enter into uncertain times. Yeah,
very well summarised. Our other positive feedback was Joshua from the USA. So, you know, from one continent to another.
Now, we're very international, aren't we?
I'm feeling so international and cosmopolitan. Joshua says, I heard your interview with Joshua Spodek and appreciate that you are openly discussing population balancing. Thanks for speaking up about this and opening the space for others to voice their ideas. I want there to be a discussion of creating large families of adults co-parenting a small number of children and how this can greatly enhance the children's quality in life and that of the parents. Most of the idea comes from the book Robes by Penny Kelly. And I think Joshua is speaking to that old adage that it takes a village to raise a child there.
I think that's a great and important point. We need to re-examine the whole concept of family. And of course that is happening. We are living in a society where what defines families become a lot more fluid and people are a lot more open to it. But the idea that the nuclear family is the only way of bringing up children and looking at how we develop as a society is reductionist. So, yeah, I agree. I think it's a really important issue. We should look into that more in future episodes.
Whenever I get feedback, there's normally a link to a new book or article to read. So keep them coming in. I'm really looking forward to reading Robes by Penny Kelly one day.
Yeah.
And listeners, let this be an encouragement. Contact us anytime with your thoughts and feedback, whether that be positive or negative or a combination of both. We want this to be a hub of interaction. So
we do, and we can handle criticism and I can handle my beer.
So this brings us to our next guest, Mark Diesendorf, who is the author of a new book, which he co-authored with Rod Taylor, the path to a sustainable civilization, technological, socio-economic, and political change. Now, the great thing about interviewing Mark Diesendorf is the legacy of PGAP interviews, which have led to this point. Rod Taylor may be a familiar name to long-time listeners, as I interviewed Rod Taylor last season for a book that he wrote, 10 Journeys on a Fragile Planet. And the season before that, I interviewed Steve Williams, who co-authored with Rod Taylor a very impressive tome called Sustainability and the New Economics, Synthesizing Ecological Economics and Modern Monetary Theory. So it just goes to show that degrowth world is a very tightly knit community here in Australia. We're all contributing to each other's works. And so you'll find a thread of commonality throughout PGAP with many old and new names, such as Mark Diesendorf. And just before we go to our interview with Mark Diesendorf, another thread of commonality is I've been invited to speak at the New Economy Network Australia in November. And also PGAP has been invited to do interviews behind the scenes, where Rod Taylor will be presenting as well.
Yeah, that's going to be good, isn't it?
Yeah.
So you're heading over east. I may head over east. I don't know. I'll have to do my carbon footprint calculator and see where I come up. So at least one of us is going over east for that, and perhaps both of us. So that's something to look forward to. And it's nice to actually, you know, see people in the flesh, so to speak, and interact. I mean, podcasting is fantastic, but it is nice to get some variety and to actually physically interact with people and look people in the eye as you're telling them about collapse and other things and more positive things, and how we can decolonize the way we approach the world so that whatever kind of future we have, whatever type of collapse we have, we can make it the best possible collapse we can, that leads possibly to some green shoots of something better. You never know. It's possible.
Like the metaphor there.
One tries, Michael, one tries. Talking about Nina, so the Australian Earth Laws Alliance had an Earth Laws Month in September, and there were all kinds of amazing talks and forums and so much going on, and I thought, well, I need to focus on a few. I couldn't go to all of them, so I focused on the deep ecology and decolonizing our thinking side of things, because these are the areas that I'm particularly interested in. And it was very, very informative to hear people like John Seed and Yin Paradis in particular talk. And Yin was gave an incredible presentation, and we'll leave links to that in the show notes. He really did, you know, emphasize that, you know, colonialism really is an ongoing thing, and that, you know, it is the behavior of colonialism is very much entrenched in separatism, hierarchy, competition, objectivity, rationalism, reductionism. These are all the things that we need to be challenging as we enter into whatever world we're entering into, so that we can mold a new reality that isn't based on these constructs that have got us into so much trouble. You know, the fact that we, you know, are in denial of our interdependence with nature, and the fact that we look for simplistic solutions to complexity, and of course a very colonial way of looking at the world, is infinite growth on a finite planet. So Yin is very vocal about the fact that the society that we know it is coming to an end. And he talks about how we must decolonize through profound humility in face of unfathomable forces, and how we need to embrace radical honesty, experiencing a shared intertwined existence scape. So it's about breaking those reductionist boundaries, where we understand that nothing is complete, perfect, or enduring, but all is alive, sentient, profoundly relational, and deeply sacred. So really, really important ways of looking at how we can change our approach and our thinking, how we approach nature, as we must now understand the fact that we've reached multiple limits to growth, And John Seed, one of the fathers of deep ecology, he was very inspiring too, and he talked about how regeneration is very much in our genes and history, and that if we go back far enough, we are all indigenous. You know, if we go back 10,000 years, we all have connections to indigenous cultures and traditions, and decolonization is about understanding that and looking for links back to that. And one of the things that John emphasizes is how to foster deep connection to place, grounding ourselves into the land where we live. So yeah, keep learning from place, keep questioning. Even though we don't know what the future brings right now in this moment, all we can do is hold the space, connect to place, and be the pilgrim and not the hero on the journey. That's a great quote of John Seed's.
Powerful, powerful stuff. Yeah. And hats off to the community at Ayla and Nina for connecting us to amazing people, amazing speakers. And this segues back into Mark Diesendorf very well. He and Rod Taylor recently spoke at an online Nina seminar, which I'll include links in the show notes. But I think this is a good segue for us to hear a little bit more directly from Mark Diesendorf himself. Hello, Dr. Mark Diesendorf. Welcome to PGAP. How are you?
Oh, hello, Michael. I'm fine, thanks.
I heard you had a fantastic launch last week.
Yes, we launched our new book in Canberra with a very enthusiastic crowd of 60. The keynote speaker was Richard Dennis from the Australia Institute, who really gave a clever and very, very witty introduction, and that really loosened up the group. And we sold lots of books too, which is nice.
That sounds like an ideal launch. Now, just before we talk about your new book proper, Mark, can you give us a little bit of a summary of your professional, academic and activist history, as well as your passions and what drives you?
Okay, I'll start with the passions, because I'm driven by a concern for environmental protection, social justice, peace and democracy. And I, of course, I wasn't born an activist. I guess the biggest awakening I got as an activist was after I completed my PhD in theoretical physics. I was studying theoretical astrophysics, the interior of the sun, which appears to be very, very removed from earthly considerations. After my PhD, I visited a scientist at the University of California, Berkeley, who I'd learnt only after I'd done the PhD exam that he'd been one of my examiners. But he was an expert in the field. So I visited him and I came to his lab and he said, "Hi, Mark, congratulations on your thesis. My colleagues at the Livermore National Laboratory are using your calculations to improve their design of the hydrogen bomb."
Oh, really?
Yes, this was a terrible shock to me. And it's really changed the course of my future scientific research. I decided I didn't want to do research for the military or for big business, for that matter, possibly even for big government. So I took up a postdoc position in London and joined the emerging British Society for Social Responsibility in Science. They were concerned with creating public debate about the implications, the social implications of scientific developments and technological developments. And when I returned to Australia, I went to the Australian National University for a research fellowship. In my spare time, I joined the local Society for Social Responsibility and Science there and actually became the secretary of that society. So I had an academic life and I had a campaigning life. And they hadn't yet come together. But then I joined CSIRO and I set up a wind power research project, which was an attempt to bring together my concerns, my wish to see the renewable energy develop. And at that time, there was no industry for large-scale wind power. This, we're talking about late 1970s. So my wind power research project joined other renewable energy research projects in which CSIRO was world famous for solar hot water research and passive solar housing. I applied for a grant, but the CSIRO executive tried to stop me getting that grant. And I was very naughty. I was young and cheeky. And I went around their blockage. I got the grant, created a research group, and we did some major work on how we could integrate wind power on a large scale into electricity grids. So this was very early work. But then the CSIRO executive got their revenge. In 1982, they closed down all renewable energy research across CSIRO across Australia. And for 15 or 20 years afterwards, there was no renewable energy research in CSIRO. And the person responsible for this in the CSIRO executive was the coal industry representative. So even before wind power was a threatening industry, they were so powerful, they just closed down the research in CSIRO. And that gave me the beginnings of an understanding of the power of vested interests in undermining democratic decision-making and trying to hold back environmental progress. Well, later on, I managed to obtain the position of Professor of Environmental Science and Founding Director of the Institute for Sustainable Futures at the University of Technology in Sydney. And this, again, brought together my campaigning and my academic work. And the institute that I set up there did both research, consulting, and training. It was a huge job and very stressful because the task of seeking funding to keep the institute afloat while keeping up a research program, while supervising many PhD students, and while trying to build links across Australia and across the world for research on sustainability, made it very challenging. And I moved on after 5 years of working there, up to 70 hours a week. It became too difficult. So I had a break then, and then eventually found myself at the University of New South Wales. And now I've retired in inverted commas, and I'm an honorary associate professor at the University of New South Wales, and I'm doing lots of research. I also read a large part of the book, The Path to a Sustainable Civilization, as well as earlier books.
Well, you've had a very dramatic history there, Mark, and the fighting against vested interests as well, almost worthy of an autobiography, but I'm not sure how keen you are to go back into writing another book just yet. You probably want a bit of a break.
Not at all. No more books for a while.
The most manifestation of your good work is a book that you have co-written with Rod Taylor that you just mentioned, The Path to a Sustainable Civilization, Technological, Socioeconomic and Political Change. Now, I personally believe this book is a terrific addition to the literature on degrowth and systemic change. And what I really, really love about it, and what's been refreshing for me, is that I have observed a lot in the environmental literature. There's a big framing of the issue, and often the solutions can sound a little bit diffuse or broad. But I found in the book that you've written with Rod is that it is quite, and I'm not sure if the word is prescriptive, but it's very detailed in the actions that we can and should be taken. So thank you. Was there a particular idea or event that inspired it? And how have you found the book writing process? And how's the reception been so far? The launch was great.
So there wasn't a particular event, except that I had written a chapter in a book, a very academic book that was edited by Stephen Williams and Rod Taylor. And that book was called Sustainability and the New Economics. So that was published last year. As I said, it was an edited book and it was very academic. And afterwards, I talked with Rod, and we both felt that we needed a more coherent authored book and a book that was aimed at a wider audience So that was the gestation. But for me, I just started writing. And before I knew, I'd written many chapters. For me, it was the culmination of my life's work coming together. So although the actual writing of the book took only 9 months, 9 months gestation. Yes, it was like a birth, but it was also drawing upon all my life experience and my previous writings from before that. Both Rod and I wanted to be sure of focusing on solutions. So although the first two chapters are talking about the magnitude of the problem, and the magnitude of the problem is enormous now, both environmentally and in terms of social justice and in terms of the threat of war, we wanted the focus to be on solutions. And as we wrote, we set out a number of solutions. But before we could do that, we had to diagnose what are the barriers for transitioning to a sustainable civilization without collapse. And we identified two major barriers. One of them is the power of vested interests, the capture of the whole nation state by vested interests. So you can see here that comes out of my earlier experience with the hydrogen bomb people and the fossil fuel industry and so on. Very powerful vested interests. So that was one of the driving forces that we identified that we felt wasn't getting enough attention, and it wasn't getting sufficient campaigns by environmental and social justice and peace groups. And the other major driver that we saw is the existing economic system. And we focused particularly on neoliberalism, which is an ideology that has sprung out of conventional economics. It's an ideology of small government, endless economic growth, low taxes, let the market decide on everything, all that stuff, which of course failed abysmally, first during the global financial crisis from 2007 to 2009, where governments had to violate the so-called principles of neoliberalism and try and lift, by government intervention, try and lift their countries out of the dangers that the financial crisis caused. And then more recently, in the attempts to recover economically from the COVID pandemic, we saw governments again had to violate neoliberalism, well, in Australia's case, by creating hundreds of billions of dollars and putting that money into the economy in order to keep economic activity going through the worst phase of the disease. And let's hope that we don't get an even worse phase in the future. So they violated neoliberalism principles. They showed effectively that neoliberalism had failed. But then, would you believe it, they reassured people, of course, we'll go back to our previous economic system as we recover from the pandemic. We'll go back to the old ways, small government, low taxes, tax deductions for the rich, and so on. Of course, underlying these two drivers of the capture of the nation state and the economic system, capitalism more broadly, and a number of attitudes, including patriarchy and racism and all these other things. But we felt that they are more difficult to deal with. They still have to be resisted. But we feel that neoliberalism is ripe for pushing over, and we want our book to give it a push. And that's what we've tried to do. And similarly with the capture of the nation state by vested interests. So again, it's time to really start exposing what's going on, whether it's pressure from the fossil fuel industries, from the armaments industry, property industry. All these industries are very powerful. And of course, the captors can also be foreign governments. So in Australia's case, we have been captured by the US military-industrial complex through the US government, so that instead of buying diesel-powered submarines, which are most suitable for protecting our coastline, we are now committed to buying nuclear-powered submarines, probably initially American and possibly then British, which are most suitable for trying to contain China in the South China Sea. And we now know that the decision, which was just announced, it was never discussed in Parliament before it was announced. We now know that that decision was strongly influenced by the fact that before the decision, Australia had employed 5 or 6 retired US admirals, and our Defence Department had paid them good money to advise us on our future purchases of naval hardware, such as submarines. So quite clearly, there's a strong case to say that Australia has been captured by the US weapons industry, the military-industrial complex, just like some third world countries have been captured in various ways.
I'd like to get a sense of where you see this current point in time. You know, I've just seen the data on ocean temperatures, and on top of that, the housing crisis, and as you've mentioned, all the state capture. Sometimes it's tempting just to go, oh, can't we just collapse already and put ourselves out of the misery? And I'm always kind of trying to weigh up whether it's an issue of the capitalist system or whether it's in something inherent to our species that will just, you know, bungle up any system we touch. Now, your book seems to indicate that there is some hope for a systemic change, and we're actually at the precipice where this economic system that seems bigger than Goliath is possible to top over right now.
Yeah, I don't think we can easily push the whole of capitalism over, but I do think neoliberalism has failed, and really it is teetering already. And so if our book and a number of other books and other groups give it a good push, I think neoliberalism will collapse. Following the book, I could add, I'm part of an international group of scientists and economists that has a research project on examining the foundations of neoclassical economics, which is supposed to provide the justification for neoliberalism. We're well into the project now, and we cannot find any scientific basis for much of the macroeconomic theory that comes out of neoclassical economics. And hopefully we'll publish in the near future and again try to put some pressure on the system and on governments to actually throw out the existing so-called economic theory that's used to justify endless growth on a finite planet. It's used to try and justify, by leaving it to the market, it means leaving it to the 1% who actually control the market. So that's where we're at. And we have a strong sense of urgency because, as your question alluded to, we are facing existential crises in climate change, of course. A whole existence of human civilization is now threatened by climate change, and it is actually proceeding even faster than climate scientists predicted because they didn't want to be accused of being alarmist. But in the environmental area, we now know Earth system science has shown that we have exceeded at least 6 planetary boundaries. So we're in the unsafe zone, not only for climate, but for loss of biodiversity, for loss of fresh water, through some of the basic geochemical cycles of nature, the phosphorus cycle and the nitrogen cycle, through the impacts on the land, through deforestation, and through hundreds of thousands of artificial chemicals that have been dispersed into the environment. So environmentally, we really are in a bad place. And in terms of social justice, we've seen the gap between the rich and poor increasing quite substantially in recent decades. Both in wealth and in income and in political power, this gap is increasing. And it's increasing both within countries, like the United States, like Australia, and between countries, like between the rich countries and poor countries. To add even more difficulty, we see democracy declining in many countries. We see democracy in the United States or should I say the disunited states, just falling apart. We see a current attempt by the government of Israel to take control of the justice system and destroy one of the foundations of democracy. We see a move towards totalitarianism in Hungary, and it goes on. And last but not least, the threat of nuclear war is now acute due to the Russian invasion of Ukraine, but also the US forming a very strong alliance against China and refusing the request to state that they will not use nuclear weapons first. The US has always refused to make that commitment, and NATO, which the US controls, has refused to commit not to make the first use of nuclear weapons. And that is creating a very dangerous situation in the world. So that's the background for the solutions. And yes, we argue in the book there are solutions. There is a path to a sustainable civilization, but it is a very thorny and rocky path. And I speak as a bushwalker, and that's one of the things that came out of writing the book. There are ways forward, but they really require a lot of actions in different areas, both international actions, national actions, and actions at the local level, and so on.
I was just going to say, apart from all those difficulties you mentioned, we're doing great, aren't we? Nothing to worry about. Now, what I loved about the book is that talked about planned degrowth, both what it is and what it isn't, why, you know, for example, Green New Deal or green growth isn't alone sufficient. Would you like to explore that into a bit of more depth?
Yes, planned degrowth. So we're not talking about a recession. We're talking about careful planning of how particularly the rich countries have to reduce their environmental impacts by giving some guidance to their industries and giving some support to the community at large. And the reason we need planned degrowth on a global scale is, as I've already explained, we have crossed all these planetary boundaries. So there we are. We're sitting with our life support system, the biosphere, under threat. So planned degrowth is necessary on a global scale, but because the poorer countries must develop, they are actually going to have to grow further. And that means that the rich countries have to undergo planned degrowth to what we call a steady state economy. A steady state economy is one with no growth in the use of energy, even if it's renewable energy, no growth in the use of materials, no growth in the use of land, and no growth in population. And population of the rich countries is very important to limit because it's the rich who have the greatest environmental impacts by far. And depending on whether you're thinking of the 1% with their private aircraft and multiple mansions, or whether we're talking of the average Australian who is relatively rich compared to the average person in Bangladesh or in many African countries, for example, it is we rich who are having the biggest environmental impacts. So that's an ethical justification for degrowth. So, as I said, planned growth is not a recession. If it is planned, well, it will not result in massive unemployment. But if it is planned, well, it will result in some redistribution of wealth, of work, and a greater availability of what we call universal basic services. So more public housing, more public health facilities, more public education, public transport, these basic things, which mean that for the majority of people, they will be actually better off under this situation. The only people who will be worse off are the very rich and some corporations that are really making enormous profits at the expense of the environment and of the majority of people. So really, that's what planned degrowth is all about.
We've had enough of planned growth.
I think so. Well, it's planned growth has been basically leave it to the rich and powerful and the large corporations. We really have to rein this back in, because otherwise we all lose, including the rich. If we move across tipping points in climate, we all lose. Sure, the very rich can probably find a safe mansion on top of a mountain where sea level rise and other climate impacts won't affect them, but it'll be a different world and there won't be a market for the goods and services that perhaps make these people rich. There won't be an economy.
They'll only have each other to exploit then.
That's right. A rather small field for exhaustion and exploitation.
Now, in the meantime, I was really taken by the term that came up a lot in the book, state capture, and I believe you've described it a little bit already during the interview, and our book provides two excellent case examples in the fossil fuel industry and the military sector. So I suppose the crux of the question is, how do we stop, you know, sociopathic billionaires from whining and dining both sides of the political spectrum and put in some much needed democracy and community citizen input in its place?
Yes, well, in a country like Australia, state capture is imposed by vested interests with a number of tools. One of the tools is political donations. And in many cases, it's very large political donations to the two major political parties. And you see that with fossil fuels, that even though the current Labor government is at least committed somewhat more than the other lot towards renewable energy, they are still strongly supporting the opening of coal mines and gas fields for export. And of course, when this coal and gas is exported and burned, it affects the whole planet. So state capture really involves capture of not only the government and the opposition, but the public service in many cases, the police, and particularly the media. And you can see that with the Murdoch Press, which is very much putting out the big business line, the mining industry and so on. So how do we address it? Well, we have to campaign against large political donations. We have to campaign against what we call revolving door jobs. So we have a situation where when a minister for energy or resources retires from one of the major political parties, he or she is snapped up by the resource industries that they were supposed to be regulating when they were ministers. And we've seen this in the resource and energy area with both major political parties. And the revolving door goes in both directions. Under the last Morrison government, two of the major political advisors to the Prime Minister came directly from the Minerals Council of Australia, which is one of the main fossil fuel promoting bodies in Australia. Now, I haven't yet been able to determine who the advisors are for the Albanese government, but you could bet your boots that there'll be people from the fossil fuel industry well and truly in there, because you can see it from the government's policies. Revolving door jobs have to be controlled. If a senior politician, a minister of government retires, they must not be allowed to move straight into a major job in one of the vested interest industries. Media concentration. In Australia, 70% of the print media is owned by one company, News Corp. Such media concentration has to be reduced by law. It used to be controlled by law in this country, but then that was relaxed. And so we now have a situation where not just print media, but also visual media, TV and so on, is to a large degree controlled in the commercial area anyway by one or two very large corporations. That has to be controlled. We need much more public interest research in the universities, because there's an enormous amount of so-called research coming out of organizations, very biased organizations in my personal view, like the Institute of Public Affairs, which is funded to a large degree by the mining industry, the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, that is funded by the US and Australian governments and the weapons industries. And this kind of so-called research is then promoted as conventional wisdom, even by the ABC, which very frequently asks the Australian Strategic Policy Institute to comment on Australia's foreign policy and defence policy. And foreign policy and defence policy seem to have been combined now in this country. So that has to be resisted. So what I'm saying really, and what the book is saying, in addition to specific groups campaigning on their own particular issues, like climate, renewable energy, deforestation, fresh water, soils, and so on, those larger environmental and social justice and peace organizations need to also cooperate and form alliances to campaign on the driving forces that are driving all these individual issues. And that, I think, will have enormous benefits. Now, we've seen the first steps in Australia by the formation of an alliance or a network called the Australian Democracy Network. And it was formed by the Australian Conservation Foundation, the Australian Council for Social Services, and the Human Rights Law Centre. And although it's a very young organisation and hasn't yet got a lot of income, it shows enormous potential because they produced an excellent report on state capture in Australia. And we've referenced that report and drawn upon it with appropriate acknowledgement in our own book and in our chapter on state capture. I think this is one of the key things, the forming of alliances to critique these driving forces that we've identified, state capture on one hand, and the economic system that exploits the environment and people on the other hand. And I think if we can build community power and community pressure on these two driving forces, that will have benefits right across the spectrum of all the specific environmental and social justice and peace issues and health issues that need to be addressed. So that's the basic strategy that we're proposing in the book. But within the book, we go into a lot more detail on specific policies that the community must pressure governments to implement.
So if you want to find out more, you're just going to have to buy the book.
That's right.
This is a halfway ad point. Before the interview, when we last talked, we had a interesting discussion on per capita carbon emissions in Australia. Every person emits near to 20 tons of carbon per year. And through reading the book as well, I did wonder to what extent individual changes can bring you down to, you know, 5 tons of carbon per year, or how much that's in a way dictated to by the way our society functions. And I've had a couple of case examples in my mind here. You know, one experience being a renter in Melbourne and being unable to, you know, get the passive changes, and you're relying on gas heating and things like that because it costs too much for the landlords to put solar panels on the roof. And the other example is I've managed to build a sort of passive house in Western Australia now, but the problem is I live in Western Australia. So to get to the eastern coast, I'm kind of forced to fly because the trains have removed their red service, so you're pretty much on cruiser class on wheels. Passenger boat travel interstate's become almost impossible due to the lobbying power of airplane companies. And I used to have an LPG car, which I can't drive anymore because WA's decided to phase that out but hasn't put electric chargers along the Nullarbor highway. So, you know, it's a couple of case examples to ask to what extent can we do stuff, and can that be measured, and how much can be measured by how much society dictates that it's the bare minimum that we consume.
Well, I think you've almost answered your own question, but I will.
I have a tendency to do that.
But I will add something. Well, first, what we're talking about here, 20 tons per person of carbon dioxide per year. That's not what every person, of course, emits. We want to be very clear, that's the average. Right? And some people might, particularly if they're a very low income, they might emit 5 tons per person per year, and others might emit 100 tons. But the average for Australia is about 20 tons of carbon dioxide per year. So your question then is, to what extent can this be reduced by individual actions or household actions, and how much of it is sort of embedded within the system? Now, first, I want to say that individual action is very important as a community example and in terms of community education and community empowerment. And I personally, for example, as well as having been fortunate enough to be able to make my house reasonably energy efficient and solar powered, I've also got shares in community renewable energy projects, the Hepburn Wind Farm and several community solar projects. So these are important. They get the message out. But in terms of reducing greenhouse gas emissions, these community actions and the individual household actions are really only a small fraction of the total emissions that can be reduced. Most of our emissions are caused by big industry. Some of that industry, of course, exports their emissions to the rest of the world. We also emit, without knowing how much, simply by buying goods and services and importing emissions. So it's quite complicated. But what I want to say is that the main sources of emissions can really only be controlled by changing the system. Think of it, government is responsible for infrastructure such as roads or railways. It's responsible for urban planning and land use planning. It's responsible for pollution control, for building standards, for taxes, for public facilities, and for possible universal basic services if we ever get them. Better public housing, public education, public transport, and so on. Whatever we try and do as individuals or as families, we are limited by the power of government. And therefore, the book argues very strongly that in addition to doing what we can in our own households and amongst our friends and our businesses and so on, we have to also put pressure on government. And individuals can have very little influence on government as individuals. But when they get together into organizations, environmental groups, social justice groups, peace groups, then they can start to influence the votes that a government gets. And they can also influence the products that a business sells. So I would argue strongly that our responsibility is not only for individual action, but also for collective action, for joining in collective action. And I can tell you, to join an activist group is fun. You're working together with enthusiastic people. You can see some achievements. Even if you don't change the whole world immediately, you can sometimes make real changes in your local community. And in some cases, if you're part of a large enough organization or trade union, you can actually have sufficient pressure to change government policy. So what I'm talking about really is real democracy. Democracy isn't just voting once every 4 years or so, but it's making your voice felt through collective pressure, through community organizations, making your voice felt on the decision makers, whether they're in business or in government. We argue in the book that we must make our voice felt to discard neoliberalism and the ridiculous neoclassical economics that underlies it. And we must address state capture, we must expose it, and we must diminish it.
one of the many reasons to read The Path to a Sustainable Civilization. Do you know what else I love about your book, Mark?
Well, please tell me. I always want to hear something positive.
You mentioned population in it.
Yes.
To you, what is the role of population growth in environmental impact and social injustice? And I note that in your book, you know, the population forms part and parcel of a whole range of things that we need to do to address. So do you find that discussing it within that context,
yes,
the issue palatable then on its own?
Yes, well, population is one of the drivers of environmental destruction. If you increase the population and nothing else changes, environmental impacts will increase. But it's not just population. It's population is part of consumption. The more people are consuming, the greater the consumption. And it's the consumption and the production of goods that are consumed that has the environmental impacts. So I would see population as one of the drivers, as part of consumption. You can think of consumption as population multiplied by consumption per person. And consumption per person is the average level, perhaps in a country like Australia, and that is a major driver, and then so is the number of people. So they have to be both addressed. It's very hard to talk about population, even among the Greens, because immediately they say, oh, to talk about population is racist. Well, that's absolute nonsense, of course. There's no connection. It only becomes connected if you say, we will not have immigrants from this particular ethnic group or this particular country. Then it becomes very biased. Or we will only have New Zealanders coming to Australia, where there is a bias, a positive bias. But population on a global scale and also on a national scale, because every additional Australian ultimately produces more additional greenhouse gas emissions than an additional person almost anywhere else in the world. So population is an issue that must be addressed, and we cannot have a situation of endless growth in population, and we can already see how it strains the infrastructure. Now, my concern about population is actually primarily in the rich countries because, as I said before, the rich have the biggest environmental impacts. That's well established. And so every additional rich person is going to have more environmental impact than an additional person in Bangladesh or in Nigeria or somewhere there. What we should really be doing is increasing our foreign aid and not tying it to trade the way we do. Instead of taking the best and the brightest people from less developed countries, we should be aiding those countries and aiding those bright people to have rewarding careers in their own countries. Now, population also can impact on social justice. If population keeps increasing, that means there's less resources on average for each person. Less land, less food, less fresh water, less timber, less minerals, and so on. And then what happens is that the rich grab the lion's share of the resources and the poor majority get poorer. So increasing population can lead to increasing social inequality, social injustice as well. So population is an issue that must be addressed. Sadly, it's even some of the demographers in this country seem to be committed to the notion of endless growth in population. It's just not feasible on a global scale. And in a country like Australia that is mostly desert, it is not feasible here either.
And there's at least one more thing that I like about your book. You're going to have an ego by the end of this conversation.
Oh,
you mentioned MMT. That features prominently on this podcast in many interviews with guests that we've had on MMT. And I was particularly excited that you described how the knowledge of MMT can be used for transforming our economy. Do you want to touch base into how some of the ways and understanding of MMT can help that?
Well, to transform our civilization to one which is sustainable, we will need some money. We will need some investment. to make the change. Investment in new industries, investment in universal basic services, and so on. Now, modern monetary theory shows us it's really an alternative, better way of understanding macroeconomics. And it basically says that countries like Australia that have control over their own money system, and those countries, under certain conditions, can create money without creating inflation. Now, I have to be very careful here, because some enthusiasts for modern monetary theory, for MMT, seem to think it's a magic pudding, and you can just make as much money as you like and there's no problem. What modern monetary theory actually says is that provided you create money that is spent within your economy, and provided your economy has the capacity to cope with that additional money, so provided the economy has sufficient available labour, raw materials, technologies, educated people, to provided the country has that economic capacity and hasn't exceeded it, then you can create more money. And of course, the government has created a lot of money in response to the pandemic. For example, the government in this country created hundreds of billions of dollars. Of course, they don't frame it as if they'd created that money. They say, we bought bonds. Well, in the first place, they sold them and then they bought them. But they say that they'd borrowed the money and had to pay it back. But it's not necessary to borrow the money. They can just create it with a key touch. It's the same thing. What creates inflation is not the creation of money, it's the spending of money, not just by the government, but by the whole national economy. And if that spending exceeds the capacity of the economic capacity of the country, if there isn't the workforce to make use of that money, if there aren't the raw materials, if there aren't the technologies available, then prices will go up. Then you'll get inflation. So, as I said, MMT is not a magic pudding, but under the right circumstances, it can finance a transition to a more sustainable society. And this goes right back to John Maynard Keynes, who wrote a paper before World War II for the British government on how the British government could finance its possible participation in a looming world war. And his whole argument was just the argument I put to you, because I've read his paper and it really is a very good one. So basically, it's not a question really of money, it's a question of having a labour force, mobilising it, closing down industries that aren't productive, which is what many countries did during that World War, and focusing on the industries that count. And that's what we're faced with now. We need to focus on new clean industries, and we need to finance them, and we need to close down wasteful industries that aren't helping the transition or even undermining it. So we need to have a phase out of fossil fuels, obviously. We need to cut down on the financial services industry, most of which is just a gambling exercise. It doesn't contribute, mostly, to the productivity of the economy. It's just a gambling exercise that where people win and lose money. And so much of that financial service industry could be closed down with the right carrots and sticks. Carrots to transition people to more useful industries, more environmentally sound industries, and sticks to give disincentives for destructive industries to continue. So modern monetary theory has a role to play in understanding how we can operate the economy of the country realistically. And for me, it's had great insights, because in my younger days, I tried to understand economics and I just couldn't make head or tail of it. I'm a scientist and it just didn't make sense. It was full of arbitrary assumptions, ridiculous models that bore no relation to real people and real economies. And I just couldn't get my head around it. And I initially thought, it must be something wrong with me in my understanding. But now, looking back, I can see it's neoclassical economic theory that is nonsense. As I read Bill Mitchell's textbook on modern monetary theory, I start to understand how an economy and the banking system within the economy actually works. And it's illuminating. You know, we are taught wrongly that banks lend out the money that people deposit as savings. It's not true. Banks create money too. When they lend money, they create money. It's irrelevant how much savings they have. So the whole system is different from the way we've been told. And of course, many economists know this, but they don't say it publicly. And some politicians understand also that much of neoclassical economics is nonsense, but they don't acknowledge it publicly because they know they would immediately be attacked by economists, by people who've spread through the community after they've been educated or miseducated in economics. And of course, they'd be attacked in the media and so on. But really, I think the time has come to get much more realistic about how economies actually work and don't work. And I think the insights from modern monetary theory can be very valuable indeed.
It is liberating when you get your head around MMT, but also this feeling of insidiousness that we've been sold a lie for so long that has affected our lives just so tangibly and often to our detriment. We're coming to the end of the interview. Like infinite growth on a finite planet, all good things must come to an end, even this interview. PGAP often looks at the environmental and the economic side of things. Very rarely have we actually looked at things like war, and I know that comes up in the book, and I know that's something that's very, you know, raw for you as well. Tell me of some of the strategies described in the book, and perhaps this can be a last question, for reducing the incidence and severity of wars.
Well, the United Nations has a treaty that governments of countries can sign that they will not have nuclear weapons now or in the future. And Australia has not signed that treaty. Many countries have. None of the nuclear weapons countries, of course, have signed it. But the problem is that the supporters of nuclear weapons countries like Australia are also hesitant to sign. So I think that would be helpful because the treaties are sort of a moral force, if you like. And the more governments that sign them, the more they actually have pressure, exert pressure on countries. So that is one approach. Another approach is that it's possible for the Australian government, for the Australian Prime Minister or the British Prime Minister to make war on another country or join in a US-initiated war in another country.
Oh, has that ever happened?
Yes, has it ever happened? Without any discussion in Parliament. The Prime Minister alone has that power in this country and in the UK. Now, there is a growing movement that says that no Prime Minister or no Cabinet should have that power to just go ahead and make war, whether they declare it or not. And of course, Australia has done that on a number of occasions, drawn in by the US government into wars that have been very destructive for all concerned and haven't achieved their alleged goals. And of course, the most notable one that Australia was drawn into by the US was the war in Iraq, because it ended up killing hundreds of thousands of people, mostly civilians. It didn't achieve anything of substance. The alleged justification was that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. There were not. Experts said at the beginning that there was no evidence, but we were drawn into that. And we've been drawn into wars, of course, earlier on in Vietnam, more recently in Afghanistan, and all of them have been destructive and useless. So I think that's a sample There are many more things we could do to reduce the probability of war and also to reduce the likelihood of nuclear war. But of course, there's no way of totally removing that risk. And the risk at present is very great indeed.
It's a bit of an existential note that we're ending on there, but your excellent new book, The Path to Sustainable Civilization, certainly gives us some hope and some really tangible suggestions to get out of this collective soupy mess that we've all got ourselves into. Now, if listeners would like a copy of your excellent new book, The Path to a Sustainable Civilization, where can they grab a copy and how can they follow your work more broadly?
So Rod has created a website called sustainablecivilization.com. So that's the easiest way. Go to sustainablecivilization.com and then click on our publisher, which is Palgrave Macmillan. And they can sell a book to you, either a soft cover book that will be shipped to you or a digital version of the book. That is really the easiest because the publisher is not very active in getting the book into bookshops. It's not the style of Palgrave Macmillan. Normally they sell academic books online. So go to sustainablecivilization.com, click on Palgrave Macmillan, or if you prefer the evil Amazon or something else, you can get it that way. But I think you'll get a good price from Palgrave Macmillan. Rod and I will be addressing public meetings around the country during the next several months. On the list, Sydney, Wollongong, Brisbane initially, but hopefully one of us will get to all the other major cities eventually. And we will be selling books essentially at wholesale price at those public meetings. But that will take time. And time is of the essence if we want to save the world. So no, I strongly suggest that you actually buy your book now, unless you know that we're coming with our books to a public meeting.
Mark, were there any parting words?
Well, to underline the encouragement that if you are concerned about the state of the world, whether it's environmental or social justice or war or health, let me recommend again, join a community-based organization and you will become empowered as a member of a group that is actually doing things. And you will learn from one another and you will have good fellowship. So join a group, put your pressure on the government and on big business. You need to have that pressure coming from the community, pressure that makes a government feel if it doesn't do what you want, it will lose votes. If it does what you want, it will win votes. It may win seats. So get out there and make them do it.
Very great parting words there. Thank you so much, Dr. Mark Diesendorf.
And thank you, Michael, very much for this interview.
You are listening to Postgrowth Australia podcasts. Now, we just listened to Mark Diesendorf, who is a lead author with Rod Taylor on The Path to a Sustainable Civilization, Technological, Socio-Economic and Political Change. Welcome back, Mark.
Thank you. Thank you for having me back.
Now, there are just three takeaways that I have from this interview. One is I strongly recommend reading the book. It takes many of the ideas spoken during the interview and writes them out in a very succinct and quite easy to read manner as well. What I really like about the book is that it equally focuses on so many problems, existential problems we face, and does offer many solutions that are at least technically possible. Whether they will be socially possible depends on us as a collective species, but they all made sense to me. The other two things I'd like to take away for me are the focus on state capture and describing the process of which democracy is undermined by basically multinationals overtaking the political processes, which we all know about, but it was nice to have a label and a name attached to that, and an observation of how these evolve over time, and also planned degrowth. And I know this has been raised several times from guests on PGAP, but the idea that planned degrowth is not the same thing as recession. And I think that's an important distinction. My only qualifier from this interview is that I would advise people to take some care when joining an activist community group. You know, they're not all alike. And I'm just saying that from my experience, particularly in the Melbourne days, that I've joined many fantastic activist groups and also some that didn't go as well, and that was probably down to me not being too discriminating. Do take care and really do your research to make sure the activist group that you do belong with is resonating well with your own personal core values.
Good points. With activism, as you said earlier, it's important as activists that we look for the points of interconnection. We build the movement by looking for the areas of common ground. So it's really good when you join an activist group to obviously join the group, but the work that you do with activism needs to come from your own space of passion rather than feeling that you need to do this because the group needs someone to do this. If you come from a space of your own passion, even if the group doesn't work out, you still have learnt and developed and built ideas which will help build your activism in general. If you come from a place of, oh, I need to do something in the group and I'm not sure what, but I'll do what they tell me, then if it doesn't work out, it's not necessarily constructive. So it's all about where our passions meet, building on the common ground towards systemic and behavioural change.
Fantastic. Were there any takeaways from the interview for you? Any other takeaways?
Well, I love any person with academic credentials who is talking about planned degrowth and who is also talking about modern monetary theory and who also has a nuanced understanding of population and understands the context that the population issue sits in. So this is really good to hear because, you know, we need the more people with academic credentials, more people writing on the conversation, and of course Mark has written on the conversation and we'll share that link in the notes, the more respect the degrowth movement in general will garner in those circles. So, and talking about the nuances of population, it is interesting to look at that issue. I noticed that Mark rightfully pointed out that it is a global issue, and he does emphasize rightfully that people in rich countries have the highest per capita footprint, and so therefore embracing population decline in richer countries is really, really crucial and should take priority. But of course, we want to live in a world where we share all of our resources equally with everyone. So basically, us in the top 10% need to massively reduce our consumption in order to share our resources with everyone. We don't want to have this hierarchy of rich certain people hogging the resources while the larger number of people in the world aren't. But also at the same time, we've got to massively, massively reduce our overall consumption of those resources globally. So we need to be sharing the resources equally whilst also rapidly reducing. So population stabilization across the whole world is advantageous in that context. And of course, that is the natural outcome of a progressive, non-coercive society where everyone has access to healthcare and family planning. And Mark talks about the importance of foreign aid. And I would add to that, and I would say that in our society, foreign aid is seen very much as a reactive approach, like, you know, capitalism impacts the world in different ways, and then we have foreign aid to kind of mop up some of the mess. In a post-growth society, we would have a system of mutual aid, mutual foreign aid, where aid is part of the overall proactive narrative, where we're all sharing resources, knowledge, indigenous knowledge, culture, scientific knowledge, family planning, so that we all work together to create sustainable low-carbon communities.
Excellent, and that's what our planned degrowth is all about, especially the planned degrowthers who incorporate sensible population policies
into their
work. So thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
Want to end with a string of thank yous. Firstly, thank you to you for co-hosting this episode and many more to come. Thank you very much, Mark Diesendorf. And thank you to his co-author, Rod Taylor, who is also a member of Sustainable Population Australia and SBA proud supporters of this podcast. And thank you to your listeners too, many of who are reaching out and speaking with us. And you can contact us anytime on the contact form. And you can also rate and review us on Apple Music and your favourite podcast platform.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Michael. Thanks again for all of the great work that you're doing. And thank you for keeping me caffeinated.
And see you next time for the conversations we need to be having.
See you next time, folks.
Until then.
Until then.